But tonight I am especially delighted to have Stuart Gudnick here. It's really wonderful to see you here speaking at Many Rivers. Stuart is one of the founders of Many Rivers Books and Tea, and he has been a meditation teacher and practitioner at the Taiyu Meditation Center for 30 years, approximately.
Well, no, since 93.
Since 93. And also...
18 years.
I understand interviewing or...
In conversation with
is Rob Schmidt, who is the director and one of the meditation teachers at Taiyu Meditation Center, who has been practicing in that fourth way rooted tradition for over 30 years, if I'm not mistaken.
That is true, 33.
Okay, so Stuart, it's wonderful to see you here tonight, and as always, it's good to see you here too.
Thank you. We decided that in order to preserve some of my strength, since I'm still in a something of a recovery mode, which we'll talk about. Rob would interview me, which, since he's been developing interview skills with our Mystical Positivist radio show, and once he gets me talking, it'll probably he'll have to use his skill to shut me up.
That would only be if I wanted to, of course. But my first question, Stuart, is can you make your stoma talk? Those who don't know, Stuart has recently exactly two months ago today, he had emergency surgery in Italy and had a meter of his ileum, the terminal third of his small intestine. Resected, as he said, otherwise
removed.
Cut out.
Yeah, you could say I gave birth to a serpent.
Right. Or rather, you killed a serpent, because the reason that it was resected was because it's the small intestine had twisted and cut off its own blood supply and become necrotic, so it had to be removed. So, until something like 4 months from now, Stuart, and including the last 2 months, obviously, Stuart has had his small intestine terminate in a what's called a stoma, which comes out of his the wall of his side
abdomen,
and that empties into a what's called an ileostomy bag.
Yeah.
So he in particular has had to become very familiar with the look and feel of a part of the body that one rarely gets a chance to interact with. I've gotten to help, touched, and helped treat the area of immediately around the stoma and the stoma itself. So I can say I've touched someone's living small intestine. It's a kind of a trip. At first, after a while, you get used to it, like anything else. But that was the occasion for the joke. It actually does sometimes make noises as if it were speaking.
If we're very, very quiet tonight, you might hear it go. If I drink lots of tea, it'll probably in the midst of the talk have to run out and drain my bag, because it just says essentially. What I drink in goes out, with some exception. But
right. We don't need to go into all the medical details.
Yeah.
But anyway, that was my first question. And so, do you have another answer?
Yeah, it's all right.
Well, we, as Stuart said, we have been cultivating the art of spiritual conversation with one another and with guests on Stuart's radio show, The Mystical Positivist, which began in December of last year. And so it seemed to me, when I saw Stuart's energy flagging a couple of hours ago a little bit, I said, well, why don't I just take up a little of the slack and ask questions. And Stuart usually requires little as he has already indicated, little incentive to respond to questions. So I think it would be nice for those people who haven't heard you speak about this question before to start with what you mean by mystical positivism and why you started the radio show and blog by that name.
So mystical positivism is a term I think I may have, I don't know if, I can't remember for sure if I coined it or if a friend coined it, but probably close to 30 years ago. I don't. Do you remember, Dan? If I think it was something that I came up with Sid, but it was a mutual friend. But when the term kind of returned when we were thinking about a radio show, because in many ways it captures the sensibility of our own spiritual practice, and certainly for myself it captures a sensibility of how I engage in spiritual practice and some of the ways or tools which I have found indispensable for engaging in this kind of work. My own influence in Tayu meditation fits probably most closely under the title of Fourth Way Spiritual Practice, which is the Gurdjieffian tradition, although our Tayu tradition itself is different in many ways. But that tradition itself, sometimes to a fault, but also it's part of its strength, has a basis in rationality or a basis in verifiability in terms of claims that the tradition makes. So in other words, in the Fourth Way tradition and in our Tayu tradition, it's absolutely critical that if a claim is made about a way things are spiritually, that it's incumbent on a practitioner to demonstrate that in their own practice before they accept that as having any sort of truth value. So that immediately introduces a notion of verifiability. Verifiability is kind of a bedrock of the scientific method, because truth claims in a scientific context are subject to verifiability, which means that there is a way to ask a question, do a practice, investigate, demonstrate to oneself whether something actually makes sense, is true for oneself, or doesn't make sense, in which case you could say it's false for oneself, or at least it's not, it doesn't rise to the level of something that you would treat as a working truth. Now, in spiritual practice itself, there's a whole lot of things that you would think on the surface don't lend themselves to verifiability, because we're dealing with subjective experiences. And again, this is where I think the rationality, or if you want a more colorful terminology, the diamond sword of discrimination comes into play, because many times we have experiences and our minds, our formatory minds, are kind of have the habit of assigning explanations to what goes on. And one aspect of treating verifiability and treating discrimination as a virtue in this regard is that we don't necessarily, we have to be very skeptical of what we say is true, or what kind of ideation we associate with our experiences. And so, to me, a tenet of mystical positivism, in part, is a kind of a healthy skepticism about claims we make about our own experience, and yet a kind of a sense of discernment about the things in our experiences which we know to be true. So that kind of gives a flavor for the positivism part of mystical positivism, because positivism is really refers to a philosophical pursuit or a philosophical position that looks at testing empiricism, doing experiments, looking at the results of these experiments and drawing conclusions based off of things that you can verify. That's what positivism is really about. It's kind of a philosophical version of the scientific method, if you will.
So Stuart, earlier this evening, related a one-liner observation aphorism from our mutual acupuncturist, who told him tonight that a belief system is BS. So that might be an aphoristic summary of positivism,
right,
as you're using it.
Right. So the mystical side of mystical positivism speaks to what I guess my sense and my understanding of mysticism in various spiritual traditions, which is a line of practice that asserts that we have what it takes within ourselves to have a direct relationship with the absolute, or with God, or with whatever greater sense of beingness is present in this universe. That we don't need an intermediary. We do not need a priest. We do not need an ultimate, system or religion between us and our direct experience of the truth. So mystics in many traditions always run into trouble, because whether you're a mystic in a Christian context, an Islamic context, or it comes up in various religious forms, typically religious hierarchies don't like mystics, unless they're savvy, like a Saint Francis who works within the system and kind of hides his mysticism while bowing and deferring to the hierarchy. But usually mystics are persecuted. But mysticism itself speaks to a claim that we do have direct access through our own experience. So mystical positivism basically ties these the concept of mysticism, that we have direct access to deeper knowledge about our beingness and our relationship to the whole of the universe, and positivism, which is a way in which we start with a kind of a skepticism. Also, we start with a willingness to hold hypotheses while we do tests, and then we can constantly ground in our direct experience what our understanding is. And the reason I emphasize the skepticism here is that it's very common, as I was alluding to earlier, for people to have a kind of mystical experience or an intense experience of some sort, and to project upon that some sort of conclusion based off of whatever system they might be working in. And the problem with that is that when our minds do that, our minds essentially take hold of that experience and rob it of any deeper energy or content, because we've kind of bracketed it off. And now it becomes sort of an attribute of our ego. I have had this experience, as opposed to not drawing any conclusions about the experience, or the raw energy of the presence of the experience is more available, and we can, if anything, kind of go, huh, or open our hearts more fully to going deeper with that experience. It's also the case that as one pursues that kind of path, it becomes possible to riff on talking about one's experiences, but one also is constantly kind of reminding oneself that belief system is BS, that whatever I'm saying about my own personal experience, whatever mystical experiences I have, I really have to hold with a kind of a skepticism and be prepared for the rug to be pulled out from under me, and whatever structures I impose could just disappear in an instant, and that has to be okay. To me, that's the essence of mystical positivism. It's kind of an adroitness in which we don't have to draw conclusions, and yet we can enjoy the fruits of conclusions, just like we might listen to music. We have ideas about things, and those ideas might suggest additional lines of exploration, but we should be prepared in an instant to let that go should we be faced with experiences which run counter to what our ideas are about our own experiences.
So maybe I'll just open the conversation to the audience if there are any questions at this point, observations. This is all pretty clear, I think. So when we were coming up with a title for this talk, it was clear, and that was back a month ago or so, that Stuart's experience with his near-death experience, actually, it's fair to say, would be a fertile ground for him to speak from. And since he's still in this, has been in this, in this mystical positivist bent.
Not near death.
Not near death. He's doing well. He's recuperating and recovering nicely. In fact, the doctor the other day was kind of shocked at how much weight he'd regained, because it's not easy to gain weight when you've lost the small intestine and the use of the colon in the way that he has, so quickly anyway. So after a month or whatever it was, five or 6 weeks, when he kept losing weight, suddenly we figured out a way, or he figured out a way to turn that around, and so he's doing well. But what I wanted to point to was the fact that when we were coming up with the title for the talk, it seemed clear that the way that you had been describing your experience was something that would be an interesting juxtaposition to this idea of mystical positivism, and the term that came to your mind was transfiguration. So why don't you talk about that and what that means?
And I think that the way I would put that, or another angle on that, is that what I want to talk about in part this evening is, how does a mystical positivist deal with a close brush with a serious illness? And, you know, what spiritual conclusions might I draw from that? And what lines of exploration? And what conclusions might I be tempted to draw? And how do I verify those conclusions for myself? It all sounds fairly, you know, when I say it that way, it sounds very heady or intellectual. But the reality of that yearning and that questioning actually takes place at in this particular case, at a much more body and emotional level. But I'm trying to articulate it now, both for purposes of this talk, but for purposes of my own looking at it, to see how I go forward. So just for more context in terms of what Rob was describing a little bit, the situation that I was confronted with was that we were going on a family vacation to Italy. And prior to that vacation, we were flying out, Rob and I were flying to Rome on a Saturday, and on Wednesday I started to feel kind of a stomach cramp, which seemed like indigestion. And because I'd had experience almost 6 years ago with appendicitis, I thought I should go try to see my doctor before I leave, and managed to squeeze in an appointment on Friday afternoon. And of course, they didn't have much time to do much of anything except a blood test, and the only conclusion they could possibly draw was, well, you don't have any sort of bacterial infection, it's probably gastroenteritis, so, you know, you'll have this for maybe 10 days, which for a two-week vacation was not particularly good, but, you know, given our schedule and the fact that we were coordinating with several groups of people in Italy, we decided to fly out rather than to disrupt the plans that we had. And as it turned out, what I thought was gastroenteritis didn't really subside, and I wasn't able to, there was no movement, you know, the condition just stayed until finally...
Well, also no movement of food.
Yeah, no, it was hard for me to eat, and... there
and
was no
passing any food.
Yeah, I wasn't passing anything, and unfortunately, this is where the internet can be your friend and foe, because I could map all of the symptoms I was having on symptoms that were described for gastroenteritis on the internet, and if anything, that probably prolonged my not doing anything about it because nothing that I was experiencing was completely inconsistent with what was going on or what was described as gastroenteritis. But eventually we kind of felt like maybe we should go to the emergency room. And we went on a Friday evening to a little town nearby where we were staying. And from a experiential point of view, it was an interesting ride because I go to this emergency room. Very few people speak English there. And it turns out that all these little hospitals in the area we were staying that were part of a town were in the process of closing down and consolidating to a new regional hospital that was being opened shortly after that. So in this emergency room, I was probably the last emergency room patient in the ospedale in Todi, Italy, because they dealt with me and they said, okay, well, we need to do more tests, but we're closing down tomorrow. And the surgeon kind of came in to look at the results said, I'm a surgeon without a surgery room. So they put me in an ambulance and sent me up the road to a little town called Marciano and put me into the hospital there. And they were that hospital was going to be open for another week and a half, so there I had a little extra time there. And so they basically overnight. I stayed there overnight, and in the morning they kind of did the same set of tests with a few additional tests. And in the morning, and by mid-afternoon, the chief surgeon there who could actually speak English came and explained to me that they needed to basically open me up, and they thought that I had some sort of obstruction, and they needed to find out where it was and how to deal with it. And so I had to sign release forms, and basically, they did a nice long incision. It's very interesting in Italy. Very unlike the U.S., because it's a single payer socialist medicine. There's some of the features we come to expect here aren't available. You get the basic service, but I went in my T-shirt, and they just rolled my T-shirt up. They didn't ever put me into it. Yeah, actually, I had one of those T-shirts. Yeah, which I thought was ironic to have the skeleton Virgin Mary in Italy as my symbol there. But yeah, they just rolled the T-shirt up and did the surgery and then rolled it back down. So I came out of surgery in the same T-shirt I went in.
And like sterile conditions, huh?
You know, it's funny. You know, and yet I didn't get an infection. You know, it makes you wonder. But I came to realize that I think families bring provisions for the people who go into the hospital a lot more than they do here. You know, there was no gowns or anything like that. But
although I wonder if that was an artifact, possibly, of the fact that they were closing everything down. And in the hospital in Marciano, there was almost none of the bathrooms had soap or towels.
Or even toilet paper at one point.
Or even toilet paper. Yeah. You know, I mean, they were just really in shutdown mode.
Right. But so basically, I went through the surgery successfully. The doctor explained afterwards that they had removed a meter of my small intestine. And they terminated the small intestine in this stoma that Rob was describing, and that's intended to be temporary, but the idea is that 4 to 6 months after that surgery, I'll have another surgery that will reconnect my small intestine to my colon. But they didn't want to do it there because they were afraid of infection, because there's quite a lot of necrotic tissue, and they don't. Here, they want to wait as long as possible because they want the scarring to settle down. So I was confronted with this situation, and what was interesting for me was that there's a principle, a spiritual principle, that's a good ally, particularly in the, what I'd call in the intellectual center realm, which is the principle of acceptance. So one can have a relationship to the universe where one doesn't feel in opposition to what's happening, but one sort of moves with what's happening. That doesn't absolve one of responsibility for making appropriate decisions or trying to take responsibility for action. You know, this isn't a justification for inertia, but it is a a guideline or a principle which can help in dealing with situations that are so clearly bigger than oneself that there's not a whole lot you can do about it. So, for instance, I was confronted with a situation where basically there was nothing I could do about it. You know, I'm being told by a surgeon that I have an obstruction. That's definitely consistent with my experience and some of the, you know, detail I didn't mention, but, you know, is the data points in terms of, you know, how a mystical positivist might think about this. When I was checked into Marciano, one of the first things they did, which was an experience I don't care to repeat, was to take a tube and go run it up through my nose and down into my stomach. And Rob is likes to tell the story of when the on-call doctor, the gastroenterologist who was on call that evening, basically came in and showed me this tube and pointed to my nose. I said, no, no thank you. I don't want that. But they managed to get it in. And I could feel the sort of cracking as it sort of pushed my septum. And then they have you drink water so you start to swallow, and then they really start to push it down. As soon as it got down to my stomach, then I started to evacuate my contents of my stomach. And as it turned out, much of the content of my stomach contained fecal matter because my whole system was being backed up. And I'm not telling you this to gross you out. I'm just telling you this because I had a direct evidence that I was dealing with something much bigger than myself. And in the face of that, acceptance is ultimately the only thing that we can really do. You know, I didn't really have any choice in the situation. It seemed, the whole situation seemed like a setup. Why am I in this Italian hospital with this happening? Why do no people speak English? Why did this come on, you know, 2 days before a big family vacation that we've been planning for, you know, a good part of a year? It seemed like a setup. It seemed like here's this wonderful, absurd situation that I'm moving into, and all I can do in the face of that absurdity is to accept. And that doesn't mean that I didn't have highs and lows, and it doesn't mean that I didn't have times where I felt, particularly post-surgery, depressed or really low energy or things like that. It wasn't like I was a beaming yogi or something in facing all this. I had very human responses, but the acceptance, the principle of acceptance, tended to be a guide or a buoy that would always kind of bring me up to a point of remembering, yeah, this is what's happening. This is what's happening now, and all I can really do is to move forward. So, from a point of view of mystical positivism, I had a sense of, like, all I can really do is just, like, look at this experience in the face, move with it, let it do what it's going to do, and do the best I can with it. And, you know, I've never experienced anything quite so intense in the sense of the body, the invasiveness at a body level. You know, I had appendicitis, and it was a fairly nasty appendicitis, and it had some of the hallmarks of this experience, but the recuperation time was, you know, a couple weeks, not a couple months. And for me, you know, the process of, you know, being in a hospital, basically feeling, you know, kind of very low energy, but also having all these new things to look at, like the fact that I had this little volcano in the side of my abdomen that was constantly draining stuff, and having to deal with trying to communicate with nurses who had very few words of English. In retrospect, it was kind of funny. At the time, it was kind of frustrating. And then Rob and my sister were, for the most of my hospital stay, they were in the area, but they weren't nearby. So I had these long evenings where I was completely alone and in a hospital that was closing down in a few days. And there were some fascinating experiences I had in terms of what E.J. Gold calls the transit experiences. For those of you who don't know who E.J. Gold is, he's a kind of call him a crazy wisdom spiritual teacher who operates out of Grass Valley, but he was one of the primary teachers of the founder of Tayu Meditation Center, Robert Innes, and so he's one of my spiritual grandfathers. And one of the constructs that he often uses in his work material is this notion of transit. And he has written Americanized versions of the Book of the Dead, and he talks about moving through the bardos between lives. And all of this is sort of like both speaking to what happens when we die, but it also speaks to what happens when we fall asleep and lose attention and move from one state of awareness to another state of awareness. So there's it's a rich field of metaphor. But so he has all these interesting images about being in these hallways and, you know, these dark hallways with odd lights and weird things happening. And I found myself in that situation. There were times in this hospital where, particularly, I think there was one night where I think most of the staff was going to be off the next day. So it's like
it was an Italian national holiday.
Yeah, Italian national holiday. So they had a skeleton crew to begin with. But I was at a point where I was exerting the effort. Like, if I couldn't fall asleep, I would get up and start to walk around, which was no easy thing to do, obviously.
But they were encouraging.
Yeah, but I realized from my appendix days that that was something that is important to do for the body. And so I would go out, you know, it's probably like 2 in the morning or something like that. I'm in this big building. There is not a soul around. None of the staff are around. The staff room is dark. There's not that many people, and the people that are in the beds are asleep. And so I'm like in this huge building, this long hallway, and there's no one. And there's a few incandescent lights here and there. So there's this kind of soft, eerie lighting. And I would kind of walk up and down this hallway in this large structure, and literally be alone. And I swear, you know, that captured the flavor of the experience for me, because I felt so much like I was on my own in this space. And I was reminded then of that kind of transit experience, you know. And you know, EJ's guidance in transit is always kind of warning you to not get caught into an association, or not get caught into a desire, because that's sort of like a womb and you'll be reborn. And you can take that as a literal, you know, rebirth when you're dead, or between lives, or you can take that as a metaphor for falling into an identified state of mind.
Well, I'll just point out that, in fact, at the end of this corridor he's talking about was the maternity ward, which was one of the main parts of this hospital.
Yeah, that's true. That's right. The one end was the maternity ward.
The morgue?
No, it wasn't. Yeah. I think the morgue was on a different floor. But
this way, rebirth.
Yeah, that's exactly. Right. So I would walk to rebirth, and then I would walk to the other end, which was a fire escape. You can read whatever you like into that. So, but through that period, again, the notion of acceptance comes up, because here in this space, all I could really do is take in these impressions and not draw large conclusions about my life or what was happening. Just, you know, we would deal with the mechanics of life, like communicating with my people in my workspace and, you know, figuring out what's going on. And the doctors want, after I got out of the hospital, the doctors wanted me to stay in Italy another week, an extra week, before going back to trying to fly back to the U.S. So we changed all our reservations and ended up staying in this picturesque agro-tourism spot. And so it was this guy's farm. You know, he had a bunch of rooms that he'd built out that were very nice facilities. And I basically had these beautiful views. I couldn't do much. I didn't have a lot of energy to do much, but I had these beautiful vistas and beautiful views of what the Italian countryside, and I, you know, could look over and see these picturesque towns on hillsides and things like that. But I was also kind of paralyzed, because I didn't have the energy to go like partake in that. You know, it was sort of again, I was just enduring this space. And in this whole process, I got to start to have the space to look at how did I get into this situation. And this is what's interesting for me, because it is a both useful line of inquiry, but it's also one that is useful to hold a little bit of skepticism about and not draw strong conclusions, because you can build up a mythology about your life and see draw all sorts of either romantic or dark conclusions about what's going on. And I want to be careful not to do that in the spirit of mystical positivism, and yet at the same time I need to be responsible to the objective reality of cause and effect in terms of, what were the conditions by which this situation happened to me. And I had some data that I had gained through other lines of inquiry that gave me a model to work with, and it's a model that bears repeating now. There was the language of this particular model comes out of a landmark seminar that I took, and landmark, for those of you who don't know, is the late stage version of what Werner Erhard started as EST long ago. And it's been sort of repackaged, refined, but I think a lot of the metaphors are still very much the same as what were in the original S material. But for various reasons, I went to one of their first level seminars to check out what was going on there, partly because a spiritual teacher that we have a great deal of respect for, Lee Lozowick, had recommended that, and actually had sent many of his students to Landmark because of the teachings on accountability. But there was a notion in there that, or a framework, when they talk about the structure of the personality. And I should say, as a footnote, one of the things that I found very impressive about Landmark, and that startled me in a positive way, was that a lot of its language and a lot of the idea structures are very analogous or very similar to fourth way ideas and fourth way psychology. So it was interesting to me in that light. But one of the models that's a slightly different gloss on fourth way models that I found useful is this notion that they have of what they call rackets and strong suits. So a racket in the Landmark formulation is a fixed way of being coupled with a persistent complaint. And so if you have a racket, you have a mode of being, typically unexamined, and a persistent complaint, which is, your justification for why you have this mode of being. So, if you think about this, it could be, someone could have a habit pattern of avoiding relationship or avoiding responsibility for relationship, and their persistent complaint could be that they can't trust people, something along those lines. And so that combo forms a racket, and so a racket basically drives unconscious behavior, and the unconscious behavior is used to avoid responsibility, to justify why things are happening the way they are, to blame others, basically to put responsibility outside of oneself for the conditions and experience of one's life. So that's a racket. The other notion is strong suit. And a strong suit is a fixed way of being that has the virtue of having turned out to be a very successful formulation for oneself. So in the Landmark model, the typical psychology of a person is rackets and strong suits. You've got rackets, you've got strong suits. The strong suits typically, they have a model, which I won't go into now, of how the strong suit gets built up. But it basically gets built up early in life, as a young person, and then as a sort of, as one hits one's majority, then one sort of like puts the icing on the cake with the strong suits. And you end up with this personality structure that has this combination of neuroses, which are your rackets, and then your strong suits, which are these unconscious kind of drivers for behavior. Well, in our own Fourth Way and Tayu formulation, there's a pretty direct analogy to rackets, and we do a lot of work in terms of self-observation on identifying rackets. In the Fourth Way parlance, those rackets are often referred to as eyes. You know, that's a capital I. It's like the autonomous psychological selves that are fragmented within ourselves that we tend to bump around and switch between in ordinary consciousness in response to external stimuli. So that was a familiar concept, but the strong suit was something I hadn't really examined as well, because it's sort of like it's something that's a lot less obvious because it works so well. It works so well for you. And I began to look playing with their model. And again, this is playing with the model. So, you know, as a mystical positivist, I'm happy to try to fit the data to the model. I don't necessarily have to assert that this is true, but the data and the picture could be useful in sort of guiding further lines of inquiry. So one of the things that I looked at for myself was seeing that, following their model, there should have been some event, you know, that was sort of semi-traumatic where I kind of decided to adopt a strong suit, or the first part of the strong suit. And my mind went back to this time, I think it was in third grade, where I was doing very well in science class on like zoology, you know, because I used to read the encyclopedia on my own and had this very kind of naive and just sort of playful relationship to knowledge as a precocious kid, and could, you know, from memory write essays about animals based off of what I'd read. So I did really well in the zoology section. And then I have this memory of getting a grade on an astronomy test. I have no memory of the astronomy test at all, but I remember the teacher telling me I got a D on that test. And something clicked for me at that moment. And what clicked for me was, like, I was never going to let that happen again. And all of a sudden, that's like the birth of me as a physicist at that moment, because at that moment, suddenly, it became personal. There wasn't this freedom, this sort of light freedom about knowledge. There was this personal self-identity associated with my performance, and I had to prove something, either to myself or to that science teacher or something like that. And in the landmark formulation, that's really the beginning of a racket. So how did that racket persist? Well, look at a kind of broader picture of my life all through, from that point on through school, through high school, into college, I found that I had this compulsive need to excel, and that my identity was sort of bound up with excelling in particular ways. And I find that there's this curious thing that I've noticed, that whenever I get grafted into an organization, whether it's a company, whether it's a spiritual school, whether it's an organization, you know, a charity organization, I have this compulsive need to rise up to the top and will actually put that into action. So I had this data point from this landmark experience of strong suit. Well, that kind of mechanical thing fits into the model, and it's not something I really question that much about. I could talk about that being automatic behavior, but it was so successful for me that I didn't really question it. You know, it made me lots of money. It's made me, able to facilitate things like, you know, Many Rivers or our radio program or, you know, our work with Tayu. I used to do charity work for a gay and lesbian mentoring organization and became the mentor leader not too long after I got involved. So I did all these things, and they all tied together with this common thread. So now when I reflect in the hospital on this situation that I'm in, and I'm looking at, okay, how did I get here? I began to realize, well, here's a hypothesis. Maybe this strong suit's really out of control. You know, I started a new job in June of 2010 when the company I'd been working for was purchased by a Israeli-based network security company. And I had to make a fairly major transition in terms of assimilating knowledge in terms of both technology and an organizational structure. And the organization I worked for was fairly created sort of crises as a kind of ongoing way of organizing and making decisions. The company would basically create crises, and the resolution of the crisis was the way that they figured out most accurately where to put resources. Very efficient for keeping operating margins low, but very stressful if you're part of the machine that's dealing with the crises. So a lot of my energy was going into this, trying to succeed in this environment. And it was an environment where I could put more energy in and it would take it. I could put even more energy in and it would take it. And it didn't seem to matter. In fact, I've now found out that I could, you know, being sick and being on disability and out of that, you know, the company goes on just fine. It's like, whether I was there or not, you know, the same things happen. And that in itself is another data point. But I realized that just like when I had the appendicitis 5.5 years ago, this event, this twisted intestine, which is not probably unrelated physically to the original appendicitis, is an indicator of something being out of balance. And being out of balance in some way is indicative of this strong suit on autopilot. You know, this thing basically going and going and going and just, you know, running its agenda and pushing, you know, the rest of my life more and more to the side as it tries to fulfill its agenda of rising to the top, of, you know, mastering the situation. Now, from a point of view of mystical positivism, it's not that I take that as absolute truth, but it is it's a working model or a hypothesis that I can now begin to contemplate. We have a notion in our work about what we call centrum of gravity questions, which is a terminology from E.J. Gold that he articulated in a book called Practical Work on Self. And a centrum of gravity question is a question that you hold in mind, rather like I think of it as an antenna, but it's a question that you hold. It can be a spiritual question, it can be a practical question, but it's a question you hold, and not so much try to elicit a closed-form answer, but allow, basically tune into a flow of answers around that question. So, for instance, if it's a spiritual question about the, you know, what can I do, you know, what does it mean for me to be awake, or something like that, you could hold that question, and you're not trying to come up with like an answer where it means this and I'm done. It means that you open yourself both mentally, emotionally, and physically to a flow of answers. So I think of a centrum of gravity question in this context as an antenna. It's an antenna in which we kind of conform ourselves to look at a particular way, hold a particular gesture, if you will. It's like holding a yoga posture at a physical level, and allow whatever associations and insights and information to come through us, that'll come through us, that shed light on that particular question. And it's not that we necessarily come up with a single answer, but that flow can help us better conform ourselves to the question, or it can open ourselves to new lines of inquiry. So for me, the centrum of gravity question that is elicited in this particular contemplation about my strong suit in relationship to my twisted small intestine, to the relationship of how did I get here in this situation in this Italian hospital where I'm roving the halls in darkness between maternity and fire, and what is that about? Well, I have a centrum of gravity question that says, okay, you have all of these factors, and maybe the question is that there is something that's on automatic. Well, now, as I get into more of a recovery mode and am about to go back to my workspace under the auspices of still being somewhat in a recovery mode, I have an opportunity to start to explore experiments with regard to that question. Experiments could be along the lines of, do I really want to be here? Do I need to be here? But they could also be, can I change my relationship to this environment such that I can shift the my whole relationship to this work environment into this kind of this $1 billion a year coming on $2 billion a year machine, and realizing now that I'm not an essential cog in the wheel like I was in a startup, maybe I can have a completely different relationship where I can have the best of both worlds. Maybe not. I don't know. But all of a sudden, there's more freedom there than I had going into this. Because going into this, all I had was driven, have to succeed, have to succeed, have to succeed. Now there's the possibility, or there's a spaciousness associated with the centrum of gravity question, which is, what are the bounds of this situation? And it's a difficult question. I mean, it's difficult because as I contemplate it, I feel like the attack dog of my strong suit nipping at my butt. You must not let go. You must not let the slack off. You must succeed at all costs. Otherwise, you will not exist. And so this is a... it's a great situation. I mean, I don't have to draw absolute conclusions, but I can create the space to do experiments along the lines of mystical positivism. I don't have any answers right now, but I do have a question, and the question can guide me to create a spaciousness around which I can explore a range of answers and then start to make a conscious decision about what would work best for goals that have wider scope than my existential need to be the best in all things.
Thank you. Maybe this is a good time to see if there are any other questions along what the lines of what Stuart has just been talking about from the audience.
I have a comment.
Mm-hmm.
And when you were talking about the word accept,
yeah.
It struck me that accept in that context is similar to the way Eckhart Tolle uses it. And when I ran across it in his book, Power of Now, I had a little trouble signing on for it until I retranslated that word into recognize.
Mm-hmm.
Accept carries a lot of weight in my own usage of the word,
mm-hmm.
of not just allowing, but kind of more like voluntarily signing up for whatever's present in an almost welcoming sense. I wasn't ready to do that. Might be a good idea, but I wasn't ready to do that. And so I stepped back away from it a step and said, okay, I'll recognize what is.
That's interesting. For me, it's an interesting question because part of the resistance that you have with accept is actually, it seems very fruitful to examine, because what is it, where is the real source of the resistance there? Accept, recognize to me suggests a kind of a distance, accept suggests a kind of a embracing, and part of the model that I have, just a very quick, outline of the fourth way in the Tayu model of, we tend to think of things in threes. So the human organism has an intellectual center, an emotional center, and a physical center. And the way that I have come to articulate for myself the drama in each of these centers is that in the intellectual center we accept, which is we stop evaluating, is what I would call acceptance, is like a cessation of evaluation or judgment. In the emotional center, we stop fighting, and we call that surrender. And in the moving and instinctive center, or in the physical center, we relax. We stop the tension. So tension, fight, and judgment represent the unholy trinity of the neurotic psychological entity, and acceptance, surrender, and relaxation represents the flowing and the movement or the release of that neurotic entity. So in the sense, so the question with acceptance versus recognize is there fight around the judgment, or is it, you know, you may have a different set of associations, so you need to kind of find a word that works for you, but, you know, it's a question that's worth examining.
I agree, and it occurs to me to ask, after you've identified what's going on in the physical, mental, and emotional area, how do you move to constructive relationship with the situation at that time?
In terms of, like, with acceptance, or?
Yes, how do you, it seems that there might be the situation might call for moving beyond passivity, for example.
Yeah.
And moving into action, moving into a different emotion that's better able to be of support to your mm-hmm. organism, and to a line of thought which brings in inquiry and what can I do for myself sort of things in this situation.
Right. So. Well, this is where discernment is, in my experience, of great criticality, because particularly when you negotiate whether the call to action is to not do something or to do something, it's very popular in some spiritual traditions to talk about not doing. That can be misleading, because it's not about passivity, because what I find is often the resistance to doing something that at a level of conscience I know I need to do is often the doing that I need to stop doing, if that makes sense. Does that make sense?
Well, say it once more.
Okay, so what I'm saying is that often the resistance to doing something that at a level of conscience we know we should do mm-hmm. is the doing that we have to cease doing in the mm-hmm. spiritual sense. Mm-hmm. And so it's tricky, because it's not, if you just take a superficial read of Advaita Vedanta that's, you know, speaks about not doing, you can read that as I shouldn't do anything. I should just go with the flow all the time, and that would seem to argue for a kind of a passivity. But the not doing is, you know, when there's that tension, that fight, that holding on, that's the doing that we need to let go of. And then the claim, again, this is a hypothesis that we can test in our own experience, but the claim that we would make is that the guidance of conscience then becomes a more free-flowing guide to what is appropriate for you to do from moment to moment. And that we do have within ourselves an innate knowing of what is the appropriate thing to do that is not being overshadowed by a neurotic cramp that is conditioned by some previous experience.
Where there's a conflict like that, I mean, it's hardly ever between... the surface level of the conflict is hardly ever where the most intensity is for me. The conflict is internally about making the decision about what's proper to do.
Right. So. Right. And that can be a very tricky thing. Sometimes it's important to allow ourselves to make big mistakes and give ourselves permission to make those big mistakes so we can get more data about what is how the universe works. And often there's great resistance to making that kind of mistake.
Why is it you would decide to make what you thought was a mistake?
When you don't know for sure, you know, like we have all these inner voices that hold back. You know, the situation I think about is like being honest with someone. Like, maybe there's something that you need to say to someone you're in relationship with that is a difficult thing to say. It's a difficult message. You're feeling this way. The relationship isn't working, or something like that. Then there's this incredible resistance that comes up about, oh, I don't want to say that because what if I'm wrong, or what if I don't want to hurt the person, and, you know, all these sorts of things. But sometimes it's better just to be frickin' honest about what's happening then. And then deal with the consequences, because then you'll at least, at a level of organism, you will know, and you will know sort of organically, whether you were out of line or whether you were courageous to provide something that was needed to be said that opens the situation up for greater honesty.
I can certainly see when there's internal doubt about the proper course of action. I was questioning. I thought you were saying that sometimes you need to make an intentional mistake.
Oh, I don't. Actually, I can even say there are times where that might be the case. I mean, our founder, Robert Innes, used to have the expression of it's good to goof gloriously. But that's more in the category of if you're not sure what to do, that you just got to do something and see what happens, as opposed to intentionally making a mistake. I mean, it's a lot of these things become context dependent, so it's hard. I don't want to make a broad brush about... I can actually see some situations where it might be good to intentionally make a mistake just to demonstrate to yourself that you can actually go beyond a certain threshold, but that's not something that I would recommend independent of consultation with a spiritual guide or something like that.
I won't ask you to make an ironclad.
Okay, good. All right, so I want to point out this much fluid and this much fluid translates to you asking Rob some questions right now, and then I'll be back in a moment.
Exactly.
See just what you can see.
it's a nice big bulge. This thing, it's actually interesting to watch. It comes out. One of some of the considerations that we haven't mentioned about dealing with waste that does not go through the colon is number one, as Stuart's pointing out, that fluid is not absorbed by the small intestine. So fluid comes through very quickly, but then that means that one of the things that Stuart has to do is, and people with ileostomies in general have to do, is to have lots of fiber in order to reduce the motion of nutrients through small intestine to allow for greater absorption of nutrition. So that is accomplished in various different ways through supplements that you have with food and stuff like that. But it's still liquid is liquid, and it tends to go through fast. And then later there can be very different consistency emerging from this this little sea anemone in Stuart's side. It really is kind of a trip to interact with it. I'll tell you that. And but you also have to be careful what you eat, because you don't want lots of big chunks of things that can block the stoma too, like raw celery, not good. Apparently, that can lots of big strands of fiber that can get caught in these things. But anyway.
So Rob.
Yeah.
Can you speak to your own kind of feeling aspect of going through this experience in the week?
Oh, sure. My attitude was first that I was sort of not real. I was never on vacation. Stuart wasn't feeling well that first week. We were staying in this lovely villa in the Italian countryside, and instead of me going off with the rest of the family on outings, I would just stay with Stuart. And we would hang out. He would be sleeping a lot. I might sit on the lovely patio with incredible views and read. I'd go swimming in the pool. I might go for a walk or a run or something like that. But so I had this sort of waiting attitude. And then as soon as it just seemed to me that there was literally no movement, then I had to sort of galvanize, and I called our doctor here, and the doctor said take him to the emergency room immediately. I had already scoped out where the emergency room was, this local town, and then I felt sort of pulled along by events from then on, but was also extremely putting a lot of attention on making sure that I was facilitating everything that needed to happen as efficiently as it could happen, so that Stuart could could survive and flourish again. So, and even when we got back, that process was still occupying the entirety of my intention for the most part for the first month after we got back. And it's only been in the last few weeks that I've been able to sort of relax that gradually. And so my it's interesting because I'm going through a period right now where I've been dealing with my father's health issues. I'm dealing with the health issues of someone who I'm a trustee of a special needs trust, and the beneficiary of the trust is having health issues. So in other words, there's a lot of people in my immediate life that have required my attention in this way. Yeah, and from having gone through a similar sort of thing, you know, my mother and Robert died within 5 months of each other. Whatever it was, 14 years ago. And so that was another period where I was, you know, on call a lot for multiple caregiving contexts. And so I'm aware that I need to provide care for this organism, which is certainly no younger than it was back then. And so I've had the benefit of knowing that it's unambiguously true that I get to focus enormous attention on Stuart's situation, but simultaneously, it is not just lawful but necessary for me to be aware of my own physical system and the emotional responses of exhaustion and stuff like that, and acknowledge those. Stuart was talking. There was a discussion around these words, acceptance, and various alternatives to acceptance. And in my own sense of my experience was that I was in exquisite acknowledgement of many things that I had many circumstances that I have had no control over. And yet, I can be incredibly effective at responding to those things. I mean, I would be in his hospital room dealing with one phone call to the United States and then another, you know, phone call to another institution in the United States.
Not to mention having the English-Italian dictionary, right, so that you can try to communicate something to the nurses.
Right, and you know, having to call I mean, this is one nice thing. The surgeon actually gave us his personal cell phone number.
So you didn't get a translator.
We never did get a translator.
I'd like to say something, and that is, for such a terrible thing to happen, there were... First, my older son speaks Italian. He was able to go to the emergency room and converse with the doctors and nurses who did not speak English, and he was able to go to the hospital and converse with the doctors and nurses who did not speak English. My daughter is an ICU nurse. She was able to monitor the machines in Stuart's hospital room and be sure everything was going the way it should be. And at one occasion, I know she made a suggestion that she thought his oxygen levels were dropping too low and that they should put the oxygen mask back on him, because he was at 89 when he should have been at 95 or above, which they did.
For a day.
The fact that all the people who loved Stuart were right there, to me, is a little miracle. Because if this had happened and I had been in the States and this had happened to him over there, it would have been excruciating. It would have been a terrible, terrible thing, worse than it is. But the fact that we were all there and that played a part, and of course I did the mother thing. I sat and held his hand for 3 hours before his surgery, which was all I could do, but which was meaningful to me and I think to him. And so I won't say that was a good part of it, but it was something miraculous that it happened that way.
So, thank you.
Yeah. So maybe this is a good time for you to talk about. We're almost coming. Our time is drawing to a close.
I thought my bag was full.
Well, the bag of the saltwater bag of your body has been your teacher, it seems to me, through this process.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if you have any discussion of what's been going on with your body from this mystical positivist perspective, from this perspective of propounding hypotheses, examining data,
mm-hmm.
and not being identified with any particular answer.
Well, I think that one of the experiences that came about for me in this situation is that my attention went from this nebulous sort of business world to suddenly, like, right here. And that's one of the wonderful things about any sort of illness. I remember this when I had appendicitis, and it happens when you have a cold or a stomach ache or something like that. But in this case, this was at a level that I'm not used to experiencing.
Another life-threatening.
Yeah, but basically, your attention goes, your attention shifts, and my awareness was very much on my body in a way that I rarely have, you know, reserved time for. So that's interesting in its own right, because there's a hypothesis here, which is, had I, you know, reserved more time for my body in terms of preventative types of things, like things like daily yoga or something like that, it could well be that I would have avoided this whole complication. Because the complication, I do a lot of things that keep myself healthy in terms of exercise, vitamins, eating good food and stuff like that, and so my body is functioning, you know, in many respects very well, but these mechanical plumbing issues were, you know, were very real, and, you know, no amount of vitamins I take is going to help with that. And It was a good indication of a imbalance in terms of where my energy was going in my life. But on the level that Rob was referring to, from a mystical positivist point of view, I found that with major health issues, you're really thrust into the situation of having to figure it out yourself. The doctors tend not to know much. You know, the doctors know, they're sort of like a perfect engineer in a software project. They're narrow and deep. So they have a very deep knowledge of a very narrow set of things, which is very critical. But they don't necessarily have a broad context. And we found, we were very fortunate, my insurance supports a Sutter, what is it, VNA, Visiting Nurses Association, or something like that, mm-hmm. where there's an ostomy care nurse ostomy wound care continence nurse who comes out, who is really very, she's more, I guess she's sort of like a field engineer. All my analogies come from software companies, so she's she's more like a field engineer. She knows how things work at a more general level. And she's actually been very helpful in terms of the transition of learning how to deal with the ostomy bag and things like that. But there's all these things that, like, we noticed, like, probably the biggest realization about how I was on my own in this regard and had to really pay attention to my body more came about because when we came back from Europe, I was fairly weak. It was incredible. You know, that plane ride was incredibly difficult just to begin with, because I was too uncomfortable in my body to sleep, and so it was like 24 hours of torture.
More than 24 hours.
And then as the perfect sort of end to that, we got to Rob's car in the parking lot, and he had packed his keys in a bag and didn't, you know, wasn't sure where they were, and the key that I guess you need the electronic thing to go with the key
to
start the car, And so all we had was the key that they gave us at the parking lot.
This thing.
Yeah, and, but we didn't have the fob, and so when you start the car, then the car starts honking and the lights go on and off. And it's like we didn't know where the keys were. It was perfect. It's like it was actually funny if it weren't so frustrating. But anyway, when I got back home, I noticed that my vision shifted, and it's like normally I can read text. I have a set of glasses for like computer screen and a set of glasses for farsight. I could no longer read text. The computer screen glasses were now the farsight glasses, and the farsight glasses didn't work. And it was strange, and I didn't know what that was about. Finally, Rob had the bright idea of, well, maybe we should go see your doctor about this.
Well, he wanted to go get a new pair of glasses.
Yeah, I said,
this could be neurological or something like that. Let's go see.
And so we went to see the doctor, and of course our doctor was still on vacation, but we saw the nurse practitioner. She said, "Well, you haven't had a blood panel. I don't know what to do about this. But by the way, you haven't had a blood panel since you've been back here. Let's do a blood panel." So we did a blood panel. I went over to Palm Drive, got my blood tested. She calls back up in the afternoon saying, "I want you to go into the emergency room. Your sodium level is critically low." And so it turned out the doctors in Italy and the doctors in the States basically said, "You got an ileostomy. You lose a lot of fluid. You have to replace that fluid. And yeah, you should get electrolytes too. You know, make sure you keep your electrolytes up." But then there was no guidance about that, so I was drinking lots of water, and which I was essentially doing was flushing my system of all the electrolytes. So my sodium level got down to a level that my sister, the nurse, said I should either be comatose or crazy. For those of you who know, it's like it was at 119, where normal is like 135 to 145, and that's super low. So I didn't have any energy. I didn't want to eat, and my vision was screwed up. So I went into Palm Drive. They started by pumping me filled with saline solution, and the doctor came along saying, "Wait, no, he's getting too much liquid to begin with." So he wanted to dry me out, and basically I couldn't have anything to drink except the occasional Pedialyte, which is this it's a Gatorade for children, so it's horrifically sweet. And basically got me to a level where I had a little more sodium, so they were able to discharge me, and my sodium level started to go up. But it went up, but then I noticed I was sort of trending back physically into the same kind of place of being weak and not wanting to eat and stuff like that. And what I found was that I ultimately just discovered for myself that if I used the V8 or Trader Joe's, has this thing called garden patch that has this obscene amount of sodium in it, that and potassium. It's better than Gatorade. I mean, it's like an 8-ounce cup has 730 milligrams of sodium, which is 30% of what you require. So for me, I'm sort of running this salt lick. You know, it goes in here, it comes out here. So the more sodium I get, and the more potassium, basically more absorbs, and then I kind of can keep my electrolyte level up and then enjoy other drinks as well instead of just constantly drinking Gatorade. But my point about that was that was something no one could tell me. You know, I had to kind of figure that out, and I still don't see, you know, comprehensive knowledge about the subject. And what my takeaway from that is that if I go to my body and just put attention on my body and kind of let that guide me, it would guide me to what I wanted. You know, like for me, Virgin Marys are, you know, the elixir of the gods. You know, I have the garden patch. I put a ton of Worcestershire sauce in it, squeeze a lemon in it, and then I basically got this perfect drink that then allows me to drink other stuff like tea and kombucha and fruit juice more freely and not worry about this loss. But that no one knows anything about that. And you know, there's all sorts of other things that you can find, like in terms of vitamins that facilitate growth of villi and the function of the intestinal walls that you know, only a nutritionist is likely to know about. And you find your way that you can't just let the system do it for you, because if the system does it for you, you know, I guess my analogy is whenever a doctor or a nurse in the hospital put the ostomy bag on me, it would fail within 6 hours. You know, failing means the seal breaks, you know, and I have to replace it.
And I should add that you know, the stuff that comes out of the stoma is full of enzymes, digestive juices, which are very corrosive to the skin. And so that's not a trivial thing.
No,
when
it's
that
not.
Happens.
It requires quite a lot of attention. But the point of getting back to what Rob was asking is that what I found in this process is that there's a responsibility that I have of putting attention on my body to figure out more clearly what its needs are. And this process, this illness, has actually brought me closer to having more of a conversation with the body than I was willing to have previously. Because when I was operating under the full force of this function I was describing, you know, my strong suit that I was describing, there was no room for that kind of conversation. It was like that conversation where I was even put to the side. You know, it's like, forget about that. I need to get these emails done, or I need to get this done before I, you know, drive home and, you know, go have my weekend or something like that. You know, there was just simply no room for that kind of conversation. And this is a good reminder.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Final comments, questions, observations?
Well, I appreciate your time and attention. This, you know, I look at this as a kind of a practical lab session of mystical positivism, of trying to give you a sense of how what that kind of abstract construct means in confrontation with something real in one's life. So I hope this has been useful and interesting.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.